Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, June 28, 2007, and I'm sure many people are out enjoying summer. So as we always expect in the radio industry, people will, you know, tune in as they can, but that's the one beautiful thing about internet radio, along with the live, the show covered live on the airwaves. You can listen to the show on the archives, and as actually many people do that, I know a lot of people have a specific time when they listen to the show, so that's one of the advantages, as I say, of internet radio. Even though they're busy in the summertime and possibly having a barbecue when the show airs live, we will, you know, I still have those people picking it up on the internet and going to the archive page, etc. So enjoy your summer as much as you can. Just a quick comment on the Calculate Primes book. It still is moving quite well. In other words, there's a good deal of interest. It just continues. The word is getting around, and it's a good deal of word of mouth type of activity where people find out from someone they know, and people are buying it for their kids. Interesting, I talked to a gentleman this week, and he's getting that for his children for the summertime so that they can study and be a little bit ahead of things next year with the math, with their math program. But at any rate, I'm going to offer a program, and I've been talking with some friends. Now that the reprint special, as I called it, all of the books being reprinted and sent out in packages, I didn't want to release this particular special on the Calculate Primes book until that other was finished, as you can't do too many things at once. So at any rate, here's what we're going to offer, and this is for students. And I don't know the exact pricing yet, but it'll be very reasonable, where you would buy a Calculate Primes book for yourself, and then you'd get another one for a nominal, basically the cost more or less of printing, a second book, and then the idea would be that you would take that to your teacher. So at any rate...
Okay, back again. this is the second time I've done this. This is amazing. I must be losing it here. I have a system here which picks up audio, and actually the show was being coming to you off of almost an auto-detect audio system. I didn't have my headset plugged in. So this is the second time I've done this. It must be that summertime just kind of losing it here. So if you noticed a little bit of a change in the sound there, that's because the ambient, the noise, my voice was being picked up by the ambient microphone and not my headset. Interesting. So just as I said, the Calculate Primes book, it'll be kind of a special for students to encourage you to take the book into your classroom, your math class, and say, you know, this is a topic that I really think you should be teaching here, which it is. And that brings up the importance of the Calculate Primes development. And it's really interesting to see the reactions from various professional communities, and in some cases, the lack of reaction. So... It's quite a the topic really crosses a lot of boundaries, and as with many things in science, mathematics, etc., a discovery all of a sudden seems to change the situation out there. And people are somewhat reluctant to accept it. In the encryption world, people are standing there with their jaws open because of the importance in the encryption world. And I get a kick out of this. I'll mention that many people have emailed and they say, there is a prize out there. You could win $30,000 if you break this RSA encryption code, which is based on prime numbers. It's basically, you're just factoring a very large number into a set of prime numbers. And there are some prizes out there, and as the numbers get bigger, the prize money gets larger. And I kind of chuckle because I said the value of this is far more than the measly little prizes that this company is giving out. So why on earth would I give them the part of winning the prize is telling them how you accomplished breaking the code. And over and above the Calculate Primes book, there's a good deal of work that I've done on streamlining the process to factoring prime large numbers into their primes factors. And usually the RSA codes are based on two very large prime numbers that are multiplied together to get a much larger number, of course. And the much larger number is based on a pair of prime numbers, the product of those, and then a complicated formula related to the encryption mechanism. But why would I offer this information to this company, which is making, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and offer them the technique of breaking these codes for $30,000? It would be a joke. The technique is far more valuable on the open market. So I just have to chuckle that this company certainly doesn't value its product very much if it's only offering $20,000 or $30,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 for someone to crack their code and show them the mechanism, the method of determining those prime factors. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that. But the Calculate Primes book is still selling quite briskly, and as I said, the general populace is very interested in this. And it's very interesting, too, to see how the mathematics world has a very difficult time getting interest from the public on many of the things they do. Very esoteric topics. And I certainly have not had any lack of interest in the Calculates Prime books. So, at any rate, with the DVD, which shows you how to directly calculate prime numbers, a 2,500-year-old mathematics problem, literally the oldest problem in mathematics. And that's something I solved, and it's now available in understandable form in the Calculate Primes book. Of course, available on the webpage. And for people who use mail order, it's still selling for $20. That includes shipping. The address is JMCC PO Box 58 Navarre, NAVARRE, Minnesota 55392. This week, they announced that in 2005, I believe it was, was it Peru? Or one of the western coast countries of South America, that they discovered two extremely large penguin fossils. In other words, I believe what they found were skulls, and were able to identify these as penguins. And they had an extremely long beak. And these giant ancient penguins were about twice the size of the current penguin. Oddly enough, also, they lived, apparently, in a very tropical climate. They said at the time, Earth, and this is the interesting part, Earth had a temperature that was exactly the same over the entire Earth. So the penguins were a tropical warm weather bird, if in fact they were a bird. I believe they only have the skulls of these, but they had a very long beak, and I'm not sure if they could fly. The details are rather sketchy. I would expect one of the big questions would be, could this bigger penguin fly, or did it have the capability of using its wings compared to the modern penguin, which of course has little stubby wings and certainly not capable of flying. They, I believe, use them while they're swimming, but they're capable of walking but not flying. But that's very interesting, and that brings up the interesting point that in ancient times, the Earth had a very different climate. And people talk about climate today and climate change, and that we're having global warming and trying to pawn it off on you driving your car around, which is ridiculous. We've been warming up, and actually we're getting back to normal. We're getting back to the temperature profile that the Earth should have. The cause of the past ice age, of course, being that we went through the tail of a very large comet, within the past 10,000 years, and the historical record is extremely clear on that issue. So here's the scenario. We passed through a comet tail. Influx of water is extreme, and other pollutants. That's where a lot of our oil came from, the surface oil on Earth, during this vast pollution event as we moved through this vast comet tail. I did some calculations just based on the medium-sized comet Hale-Bopp, which passed through the solar system back in the 90s, and I estimated that it would have taken us about 20 days to pass through that comet tail. And given the right scenario, it would not be unusual at all to pass through a comet tail and have that last 40 days and 40 nights. So the 40 days and 40 nights of rain, torrential rain, the flood, the great historical flood, was something that was real, and there's a real explanation for it. It's not some magical thing that happened or some mythical thing that happened and is only in the remote mythical mythology religions of the past. But at any rate, the point is that before that encounter, before the Venus encounter, within the past 10,000 years, the Earth very likely had a very different atmosphere, possibly one with a great deal of water content, one with a great deal of possibly oxygen. Our oxygen content may have varied, may have been very high at that point. So, what was our atmosphere like? And then let's go back to the penguins, the ancient penguins that apparently lived for about 65 million years successfully on Earth. And of course, also explained in my weather book, the extinctions would wipe out, first of all, the larger animals, the larger birds, the larger sea mammals, but the seas buffer considerably any kind of impact that is going on Earth. So the sea life, in many cases, lived through. For example, the whales and the sharks. It's well known that the sharks were in existence a very long time ago, geologically, and a lot of the on-land life died off during these radical changes when something comes through the solar system. And, of course, standard science always attempts to pin this on an asteroid crashing into Earth, and that simply doesn't explain what happened. We have pole shifts. We have physical pole shifts, that is. We have the magnetic changes in the Earth's magnetic structure in the crust and in the mantle of the Earth. These changes are not explained by a crashing asteroid. We had change in the atmospheric content. We had ice ages that ensued. So these are things that Earth did not just do by itself. Something else was going on, and these changes came from outside the solar system, affecting our planet Earth in a, you know, an explainable manner. So, at any rate, back to the penguins, twice the size of our normal penguins, and all of a sudden, they died off. So, what exactly happened there? Obviously, there were more than two of them, but just the skulls of two of these large birds remain. So, there must have been, of course, millions of these, and any trace of them has been lost up until about 2 years ago, where these were discovered in the remote offshore regions of Peru. I believe it was Peru. So the point is, clearly Earth's past has been quite different and changing. Our atmosphere was very different, and just the fact that they know that the Earth's poles, the temperature at the poles of the Earth back then, when that penguin lived, the temperatures at Earth's pole, North and South Pole, were very, they were exactly the same as at the equator. Now, with Earth's present atmosphere, relatively thin atmosphere, this simply could not be possible. The only way you could have the temperature at the North and South Poles be exactly the same as the equator is if we had a very extensive, dense atmosphere, probably laden with moisture, with water, water vapor, and much more extensive atmosphere than what we have today. Because as the poles would spin, no matter what the axis was, whether it might be tilted as it is now or even aligned vertically, so that there were no seasons, so to speak, for the poles to be the exact same temperature as the equator would require an extensive Earth atmosphere. And this is something that seems to be plausible because it seems that a lot of the animals that are in existence today required a much higher water content in the atmosphere, including man himself. People are always putting some kind of moisturizer on their skin. And we live in a relatively dry climate relative to the amount of moisture our bodies need from outside. So it may stand to reason that Earth, in fact, had an extensive water atmosphere previously, in possibly not that far in the distant past, as in prior to the comet event within the past 10,000 years. And it seems that there were many of these events. The ancient Egyptians, when Solon, I believe he was the uncle of Aristotle, when he went back to Egypt to try and find out some of the history of the ancient Greeks and where they came from, they told him that Greece was a very young country and that within the past 10,000 years, there had been many radical changes. They said five. They noted a number of five. So there were five major Earth-wide events that occurred in the past 10,000 years, according to the Egyptian chronology and the Egyptian history. So the globe, as I said, Earth had to have a very different atmospheric structure. The recent ice age that we're dealing with now, we are coming out of that ice age, and as I explain in the weather book, as you come out of that ice age, initially the warming is very slow, and as you get up to the end of that warming period, then the warming accelerates, and that's the period we're in right now, that's the state Earth is in. And the global warming is occurring, but it's not due to you driving your SUV or automobile around. There were, as I said, a number of major catastrophes in that time frame, past 10,000 years prior to, so I guess about 12,000 years ago, up to when the ancient Greeks, which we know is about, say, 500 BC, that's when the cultures began to actually record and pass down the history that we have today. Tonight's main science topic, I'm going to talk about somewhat of a very strange topic. And I know there's a lot of children, kids that listen to this show, and they're listening with their parents. And so I want to kind of give you a preview of what I'm going to talk about. There, around the world and throughout history, science and engineering have been used to create devices for warfare. And, of course, that's something that I personally oppose. I am very critical of scientists and engineers who spent their entire lives doing great science, but unwittingly building more instruments of death and destruction. Whether they're designing a faster chip or microgate in a transistor complex, whether they are designing a chemical to be used in fuel in rockets or missiles, whether they're designing a material that is lighter and stronger to be used in the construction of aircraft or rockets, missiles, weaponry, all sorts of uses. And it seems, and this is something I found out when I was working in as a scientist, is that you really did not have much say over how your developments were used. Who would take that development and what would they actually do with it? That's one of the big problems in science. And I'm very critical of scientists because they haven't taken the reins and control of their scientific developments and said, no, you cannot use this. I just want to recount an event. This was probably 1982. I was in Los Angeles with a company that I had formed looking for funding for an engineering project that just happened to deal with electromagnetic propulsion systems for outer space. And what's interesting is I was in a meeting one day with the businessmen that were going to front the money for the business. And we were talking, and they were trying to structure the company with financiers and with accountants and all of the other things you need for a company. And I said in the middle of the meeting, I don't want this invention that I had brought to the table. I said, I do not want this to be delivering nuclear warheads or to be used for warfare. And everybody looked at me as if I was absolutely crazy, because that's absolutely what they intended to use it for delivering nuclear warheads, an electromagnetic propulsion system that could take devices into space and efficiently deliver them any place in the world. And I said, no, I don't want my invention being used for this. And as I said, they looked at me as if I were absolutely nuts. And it's generally assumed that everybody works in some aspect of the military-industrial complex of the United States, and that any invention you have, if it's suitable for advancing warfare, it will be used for advancing warfare, warfare machinery. And this goes back to the very earliest fight. One can imagine a cave situation, cavemen standing there, one of them standing outside and maybe is hungry and wants something that the caveman has. So he picks up a rock, or I imagine the first blows were by hand, somebody coming up and hitting the other person or whatever, and then somebody picks up a rock and starts beating the other person, and then someone figures out that if you throw the rock, you don't have to stand next to the person and get beat on the head. You can throw it at a distance. And from that very early beginning, from that very most fundamental beginning, the acceleration, the use of technology or the use of advancements to advance warfare for one side to give them an advantage, that's where it should have stopped, right there. But of course, I'll just go through a couple other developments. Then, instead of throwing just a rock, it made sense that if you sharpened that rock, it would be much more effective. But to deliver the sharp end, you had to put it on a stick and throw that stick, as in a spear. And so that allowed you to take the rock, which you could just throw in your hand, you could carve it down, you could make the stone much lighter, and in fact you could use the volcanic glass, which was very sharp, and tie it to the end of a large stick and throw it, and it was far more effective than just a regular round rock, throwing that at someone. And then people invented what is known as the atlatl. It's a leveraged spear-throwing device. You hold it in your hand, and you can toss a spear much farther with it. It's like an extension. It's as if you had an arm that was twice as long as your current arm. So you could take a spear, much more streamlined, throw it in. That's what the early cavemen used to kill mastodons and large animals, the woolly mammoths, etc. But that is just an example of warfare advancement. In the Middle Ages, finding steel that was harder was important, because if you were in battle and somebody had a harder piece of steel in their sword, and of course they, by hitting your sword, would break your sword in two, that was an advantage. You wouldn't want to be in battle and standing there with a piece of sword that was cut in two because of use. So the discovery of how to harden steel, the bluing of steel, that what they do is they take the hot steel when it's finally smithed and put in an edge on it. They'll take that and they'll dip it in oil, and there's a chemical reaction between the oil and the steel, and that hardens that edge on the steel. It makes it much harder, right on the very edge, in the surface layer of the steel. So all of these techniques being advancements on the art of warfare. I'm not sure if it's really an art or not, but scientists throughout history have used their talents to advance warfare, and many times unwittingly. Leonardo da Vinci apparently invented many warfare devices, including the large, it looks like a large crossbow capable of shooting rocks and other projectiles, basically to break walls and do heavy delivery of heavy artillery. Another advancement was the use of oil. One of the very first uses of oil was in warfare. When it was first used around, I believe it was around 1200 AD, and it was found in Arabia, what was then called Arabia. They found it in pools laying around the ground. And they also learned very quickly how to refine it, how to get kerosene and naphtha and other chemicals, volatile chemicals, out of the oil that was laying around the ground. It was used to tar roads. They actually had tarred roads in the 1200 AD. So when the Crusades came through, they were able to look and see and understand the value of oil. Oil was also used, for example, to soak in big balls of twine, for example, and they could be lit on fire and they would burn for a very long time. So they would either throw the balls of twine soaked in oil, or as there's many other uses as used in warfare, rolling them down a hill at your opponent who's trying to come up the hill, on and on, all types of developments to give the particular side an advantage. Because if you just had brute force, two armies meeting, hand-to-hand combat, then Usually it would go to the side that had the most men. And, of course, training was very essential, as in the movie 300, where 300 Greek warriors held off an entire legion of invading military for many days, greatly outnumbered. And, of course, there, just sheer prowess and military ability was the deciding factor. But at any rate, enough of that. What I want to do is turn to the modern scenario and go through a bit of my own history of dealing with the military-industrial complex. And the reason I'm doing this is because kids today want to study science, and I would certainly encourage that. Study science, mathematics, and eventually become an engineer or a scientist, possibly get a PhD. And science is great. It's just wonderful. It makes you see the workings of the world. It allows man to create tremendous inventions, but inevitably those inventions get turned by someone, a politician, or someone usually interested in gain, trying to take over somebody else's property or resources. That's the usual reason for warfare, in spite of the fact that someone might tell you that it's evil that they're fighting or terrorism. Those are usually front stories to justify land or resource grabbing by a party. And that is simply, we see that going on every day on the planet now. So, for kids who want to study science, of course, I'd encourage you to be the best scientist you can be, but also be aware that at a certain point, scientists are going to have to stand up and say, we are not going to create another generation of super weapons to be used by politicians to further their political and militaristic agendas. So that may sound like a rather complex topic for kids, but big people have to understand this too, because you are funding the militarization. And here's what's happened. Here's what does happen. And I can tell you this from experience, that when a product is developed, say we get a better gunpowder or a better mousetrap, a warfare mousetrap of some kind, within a very short amount of time, that device, that invention, funnels over to the other side. That's what spying is all about. That's what the military-industrial complex knows very well, that as soon as you have an invention that would upset the balance and allow one side to win, then they're going to be out of business. The arms dealers are not going to be in business if there's not some kind of an equitable battle that can ensue. In other words, if one side gained the advantage, the clear advantage, and won every battle, then it wouldn't make any sense for the other side to continue to fight, unless that other side was able to purchase or somehow procure a better technology that would give them the advantage. And you see that if you want to keep the world in knots, then your goal would be to fund both sides, to provide money and funding for both sides of this conflict. And that's exactly what's going on. The Bushes back in pre-World War II Germany were funding Hitler. They were also funding the United States, and they were involved in the large oil conglomerates, which were providing oil for both sides. Now, that's a very profitable business because it creates a demand, a huge demand for your product, in that case oil or armaments. And so once they get the taste of the money and control, then it's a simple equation to understand that warfare in the future is going to be guaranteed because of the need for ongoing profits and income by the people who are supporting and generating this. So they generate the warfed scenario. They capitalize on the manufacturing and development of armament. And if one side begins to get the advantage, then it makes sense for them to move that technology over to the other side. And then these peons, the small people, the pawns out there, continue to be suckered in to fighting the wars for these people as they become rich and powerful. And once they're in those positions, they don't like to give them up. They don't like to change. They like that power. They like their position. How many of them would walk off one day? Can you see President George Bush all of a sudden saying, I'm not going to do this anymore. I don't believe in warfare. I don't believe in all of the killing that's going on. And I'm just going to go work at McDonald's flipping hamburgers. Can you see that? And of course, it's not going to happen because the people belong to families, and those families have, over the centuries and beyond, have gained power. They've gained their positions, and they're not going to give it up easily. And those positions are bolstered and are stabilized, in a sense, by creating conflict in the world. Without conflict, they would be in danger of losing their political hold on the control of societies. So it's in their best interest, if control and domination and leadership, so to speak, guaranteed leadership, if that's what you want to call it, to guarantee that, they would in fact, their process is very simple. It's been used over and over again. In fact, you had Gulf War I and then Gulf War II. And look at the technology development, the scientific advancements between those two modern conflicts. I wouldn't call them wars because neither one of them was really what I would term a war. But at any rate, the technological development, now even within months, say the cruise missile developments would turn over. And there would be new developments in the matter of, oh, maybe 6 months to a year and a half. This is all funded, and so at any rate, I'm going to go back and, as I said, somewhat go through my own personal history of contact with the militarization of science. And this is specifically aimed at parents with kids and kids who are listening, because this is what's going to happen if you ever develop something. And as I said, at a certain point, scientists have to stand up and say, you can't do this. There are many cases in the past, for example, with the atomic bomb. Einstein was remiss that they used his invention, his theoretical work, to develop a bomb. And, of course, he wrote the first letter to the President of the United States, stating that this technology is imminent, and basically that was the letter that kicked off the Manhattan Project to develop the first nuclear device that was used in Japan. So, at any rate, going back to my own college education, or even before that, let's go back to my high school. As I studied political science in high school, we were very much dominated by the Cold War. The Cold War being that mental conflict between Russia and the United States. The Cold War was brought out of the 50s, the post-World War II generation, and the idea was that Russians were going to, they were hoping to annihilate us with nuclear warfare. So we had to defend ourselves by building a deterrent nuclear force so that they, if they ever did try to bomb us, we would annihilate them, which brought about the term mutual assured destruction, or MAD. And that was something that actually led to the prevention, to the laws that were passed to prevent space, outer space, from being used for warfare. Because ultimately they all knew that if outer space were opened up to warfare, that the lid would be off, the genie would be out of the bottle, and there was just something inherently wrong about using outer space for warfare. For example, a particular rocket could be orbiting Earth, and on a second's notice, from 100 miles up, rain nuclear warfare warheads down on an opposing country, destroying it before they ever had time to react or launch their missiles. And so there were many reasons, and the other reason for outlawing the use of outer space is because of the proliferation, that is, the great increase in the development of technologies, and because it was the last frontier. You're going out in three dimension is just too huge. And so they said if they actually made laws that prevented the use of outer space for warfare. And so now the U.S. has gone into space, put satellites up there, military satellites, and said, these are not for military purposes. We're just using them to communicate. And it's really incorrect, because once somebody gets the shoe in the door, once they get the idea that space is available and that someone else might use it someday, then they have decided unilaterally to use outer space for warfare. In fact, any of the ICBMs that might come in during a nuclear war typically would go out into outer space and follow a low trajectory, a low orbital trajectory to the target country. So, at any rate, let me go back once again to my high school days, the Cold War, and the idea that scientists would be used and their inventions would be used for warfare. It was simply an assumption, and really it wasn't a correct assumption, but at that point all of the teachers seemed to think that everybody was subject to the dominion of the federal government instead of the other way around. If there was a Cold War, if there were terrorism or whatever, that the scientific technologies would be used to further our goal of fighting the foes, so to speak. When I went to college, I studied physics and mathematics. We had a professor there. His name was Wagner. And he was a young guy who actually worked in the tail end of the Manhattan Project. So as college students, we were taught how to build atomic bombs. I mean, it was just part of our scientific education. And everybody that I went to school with, the physicists, were schooled in how to make atomic bombs. And of course, the implication was there was that once you grew up and got out of school and got to grad school and graduated and got your PhD, you would be in the war industry, and understanding how to build an atomic bomb was part of your education. It was assumed, and this was at a Christian school, mind you. And but nobody raised an eyebrow, because it was just simply assumed that this is the way it is, this is the way it should be. And I got a card one day, and I'll just branch off on this. And then once again, this is from the alumnus department of one of the schools I went to. And they said they were going to build a war memorial to honor soldiers. And I wrote back, and I said, are you going to also build one for the people who didn't go fight, who refused, and therefore were a different kind of hero? But they wanted to build a monument on campus for the heroes of war. And I wrote back and I said, do you mean that you are condoning people who kill? And that's typically how heroes are gauged in warfare, is by how many people they've killed. How many airplanes did they down? You know, that's how they gain statistics on who's important or not, or somebody got shot. That makes them a hero. My particular viewpoint is that if the common man or the scientist refuses to use their talents to go off to war, then there simply wouldn't be a war, because the leaders sit back and let everybody else do the fighting for them. And of course, that's been in place for a long time. But anyway, I wanted to talk about my college days learning physics with the assumption that at some point you would get your degree, your PhD, and building scientific devices for warfare was probably what you would be doing, whether it was in basic research, whether that basic research then led to other developments, etc., etc. So, at any rate, I want to talk also about Kennedy, President John Kennedy. When Sputnik went up, this is back in the 50s, it kicked off the space race, and the Sputnik went up, and all of a sudden there was a fear that the Russians would be technologically advanced over the Americans. It was somewhat of a shock because Americans always thought that Russians were backwards and stupid and couldn't do anything, and there all of a sudden they had launched Sputnik. And then came Telstar, which was just a round device that could reflect radio signals. And so there began a kind of a technological development program in the United States to train scientists. And in fact, that the money that was released for that from the federal government aided me in my particular education as a scientist, as a physicist. I was one of those people that understood science. I was one of those people that was doing quite well in physics and in mathematics. So the schools all had money available. If they could find bright students that would go to their school, then literally my college education, my bachelor's degree, it didn't cost me a penny. I had a complete 100% free ride, as it's called. And all I had to do was earn my spending money, which is what I did. But my entire education was free. I went to a private college, very excellent physics program, and every year, as long as I maintained my grade point average, the scholarship, the grant money, I got a full scholarship with matching grant money. The grant money paid for my room and board at the school. The scholarship paid for my tuition. And so there again, the belief that we needed scientists to be trained to enter the military-industrial complex and make our side win. And of course, this was going on in Russia at the very same time. This was, both countries were attempting to train young people to develop their skills, scientific, and of course, the obvious result would be that this would be used in the warfare industry. Now I want to talk about a little bit later in my career, probably 1982, and I already alluded to this. I gave an invited talk, one at Los Alamos National Laboratories, and this was dealing with my electric comet concepts, the plasma nature of the solar system. And so I gave a talk, an invited talk. It lasted all afternoon at Los Alamos, and in attendance were about 50 of the world's top plasma physicists. Some of them new, mainly middle-aged and older professors and scientists that worked at Los Alamos. And the name of my talk was, "Are Comets Really Dirty Snowballs?" But what's interesting is when I got to Los Alamos, that morning I went over and met the people who were basically, you know, my mentors or the people who had invited me for the talk. And they asked me what I wanted to do. And so there were some options there. And so I actually chose to be a part of that morning with the High Energy Bomb Group. And so I went in and sat in on the groups. Now, understand that these were very European scientists. They spoke very little English. They were remnants of the World War II scientists, some of them quite elderly. And the day I was there, they were making bomb death calculations. These were statistical calculations, and that's where I learned how to do, for example, the calculations I've done with storms and other types of natural disasters. The tsunami in India, where I made an estimate of the number dead being 10 million and not the 200,000 reported in the news. Or also the hurricanes that came through Florida, where I was able to calculate the death tolls, the real death tolls, and of course the news media, the standard news media death toll was very low, abnormally low. So at any rate, at Los Alamos, as I said, I was with the High Energy Bomb Group, and for example, they would take a certain type of bomb and calculate in a city type of scenario the number of people that would die in the first 10 minutes, and then in the next hour, and then the next 2 hours, and the next 5 hours, and the next day, and the next 4 days, and the death toll, you know, out to weeks and months into the future after the bomb event, depending on the type of bomb, the altitude, the size of the bomb, etc. So this was just scientists at work, scientists just doing their job, doing what they knew how to do best, calculate, estimate, develop models for death toll calculations, and to try and bring this information and boil it down so that politicians could understand what they were funding. Because they were funding nuclear technology. They wanted to know, if we drop one of these over Moscow, how many people are going to die? How long do we have to wait before we can send our troops in to take over their country? And of course, Russia was doing the same thing. They were training their scientists to make the same type of calculations and to develop the science for their rockets and nuclear technology to deliver onto the United States with the same concept that you would have large death tolls. How would you manage this? What would be the estimates of the dead, the dying, the wounded, etc.? This was what was being done and still is being done at the national laboratories. Now, I want to divert just a little bit, and people think, well, these are the people that actually build the bombs, that are, you know, developing the technology, but let's take something that seems to be a bit remote. Let's take an engineering, an engineer who, say, works to develop a technology that will make the microgates in a transistor, where you have hundreds of thousands or millions of transistors on a single chip. And imagine here's an engineer who's trying to, let's say, develop a new technique for rad hardening. And that rad hardening means radiation hardened. In other words, if there's a nuclear bomb that goes off, or if this device is in outer space, being subjected to cosmic rays and X-rays and other forms of radiation, what can you do to design either the way these transistors are built or something designed into the transistor that'll make them resistant to radiation? So say you're a scientist and that's your particular field. Then Are you part of the warfare industry? And the answer is absolutely, because it gives that technological advantage. It's the same as if you were developing a harder steel for swords in the Middle Ages. It's a technological advancement that gives your side the edge. And the point of all of this, of course, is where does it all end? Where do you draw the line and say enough is enough? We are not going to develop any more mouse traps. We don't need a better mouse trap for warfare. I remember seeing one of the Digest magazines, Popular Mechanics, one of those magazines on the cover, and it had the warrior of the future. And here was a guy dressed in a obvious military uniform, and he had a laptop. He had a headgear on with night vision and various forms of goggles that would protect him against radiation and radiation fields of all different types. And this guy was so laden down with electronic gear, I bet that he couldn't even walk. That's how much electronic gear he had on him. But this is a very profitable industry. There are industries, there are entire businesses that you've never heard of, that you will never hear their names, and developing the better mousetrap, the one that'll make our soldiers win. I always find it comical, although none of this is comical, I find it ironic, that once the initial warfare, whether you have cruise missiles or B-52 bombers and nuclear bombs, ultimately it comes down to a land foot war with soldier against soldier on the ground in close confines. And any military commander knows this. So that in spite of the fact that you may have tremendous technological advantage, and now we're seeing this, for example, in Iraq, where we have tremendous technological advantage, but it ends up being a soldier on the ground, their soldier versus our soldier, and in many of those cases, it's an equal, in spite of all of our technology, there's an equality there because their gun is just as good as ours. In fact, it is said that in a lot of the cases, like in Russia, during World War I, World War II, and some of the other wars, that just a musket, if everybody had a musket, it would have made the difference between winning and losing a war. So, at any rate, the whole purpose of this talk is to ask the question, where does it all end? Are we going to use outer space for warfare? What is the rationale for using outer space for warfare? And a general critique of engineers and scientists in all fields, 99.9% of them working in the warfare industry in some capacity, whether they pull the trigger or not, they are as much involved in the use of technology for warfare as if they were on the front line and being a soldier themselves. So the question is, the question I want to end with, where does it all end? How far are we going to let political leaders use science for the death and destruction of the human race? This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.